Michael Schiavo says that not only does he want his wife, Terri Schiavo, dead, but he believes that the way he would like her to die, and that is by dehydration and starvation, he says this is the most natural way to die, dehydration. That is what would actually kill Terri Schiavo if Michael had his way. He's almost had his way once, and he's still fighting in court to have his way yet still. We're going to be talking with Wesley Smith here in the first half hour of Issues Etc. Get an update on Terri Schiavo and have him respond to Michael Schiavo's insistence that dehydration is the most natural way to die. Wesley Smith will join us here in just a moment. In the second part of this first hour, we're going to be talking with Peter Sprague of the Family Research Council about today's Massachusetts Supreme Court decision on gay couples. We'll try and figure out exactly what it is the court has said. They've given the legislature there in Massachusetts a certain period of time to act upon their decision, and we'll find out what is likely to happen there in the second part of the first hour with Peter Sprague of the Family Research Council. In the second hour of the program, we conclude our five-part series on the Liturgy of Holy Baptism. Pastor Will Wheaton is our guest during that second hour, pastor of St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. We talked about baptism last time. We're going to talk about the final parts of the historic liturgy regarding baptism, the white robe, the candle, and the final prayer with Pastor Will Wheaton in the second hour of Issues Etc. today. Then, in the third hour from 5 to 5:45, Pastor Matt Harrison joins us. He is translator of our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for November, Meditations on Divine Mercy by Johann Gerhardt. We'll talk about the life, the theology, the thought, and the writings of this 17th century Lutheran theologian, Johann Gerhardt, in the third hour of Issues Etc. Our call-in numbers are 505-7850 or 1-800-730-2727. I was at home today, earlier in the day, when my producer called me with some very sad news, and I must admit, I am simply heartbroken at this news. Bob Passantino, a regular guest here on Issues Etc., a longtime guest, he's been with the show virtually from its beginning. You know him well because he's often on with us with his wife, Gretchen. Bob passed away yesterday of a massive heart attack, rather unexpected. He had suffered some heart troubles before, but they were simply unable to save him at the hospital after he suffered some dizziness after a walk. He passed away yesterday. I would like you to keep Gretchen and Bob and Gretchen's daughters, Mary and Karen, and their son Paul in your prayers, as well as Answers in Action. In addition to that, if you'd like to, you can go to the website for Answers in Action. That's answers.org, www.answers.org. When you go there, near the bottom of the page, you will find a link that says Remembering Bob Passantino. You can go there and post any thoughts or remembrances you have. You've probably become as fond of Bob as we have over the years here on Issues Etc. Wesley Smith is our first guest. We're going to get an update on the euthanasia case of Terri Schiavo. Wesley is an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide. He's a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and he's author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. We've been following this Terri Schiavo case for weeks now, and we have discovered that the players are really playing out a very macabre bit of kabuki theater. The most compelling character here is Michael Schiavo. He seems to be intent not only upon wiping out the memory of his wife, but wiping her out, too. He said some appalling things in the course of this story, but he's not done saying appalling things. Wesley Smith, welcome to Issues Etc.
Hi, Todd. How are you?
Very well. It's good to have you back. What is it that Michael Schiavo has said lately about the means by which he would have his wife die, dehydration?
Well, he and his lawyer, George Filos, who describes himself, I believe, as a right-to-die lawyer, were on Larry King. And I wrote about this in a Weekly Standard article that was on their online edition that people can access at www.wesleyjsmith.com. King said, quote, when the feeding tube is removed, is that a terrible death? Shivo, no, it's painless and probably the most natural way to die. Well, let's lock him in a room for 2 weeks and see how painless he thinks it is. Philos, when someone's terminally ill, let's say a cancer patient, they lose interest in eating and literally, day by choice, they stop eating. Let me stop. That's true. But we're not talking about somebody who has cancer and is in the active dying process and their body is shutting down. In that situation, not eating is a natural part of the dying process in many cases, and force feeding them is wrong because it can cause suffering since their body may not be able to assimilate food and water. What you often see in this right to die quote-unquote advocacy is the intentional or inadvertent confusing of the situation where somebody's actively dying, where somebody is not dying like Terry, and all they need to live is food and water like any one of us, but they can't swallow. So swallowing, not being able to swallow, becomes a terminal condition that is then confused with somebody with a terrible disease process in which a natural part of dying is to stop eating. Those are two different things. And one, as we'll, I'm sure, talk about, probably doesn't cause suffering. That's the cancer situation. But withholding food and water from somebody who's not dying and is conscious can cause terrible suffering.
I have watched people die in the later stages of cancer, being involved with hospice, being involved as a parish pastor.
Right.
And generally speaking, when they stop eating, you know that things are getting near.
Right.
The body stops. They stop eating. But they also, generally speaking, at that stage, if they're giving proper palliative care, pain relief, they're also more or less unconscious all the time. At least the amount of pain relief that is required for them at that stage usually keeps them in a semi-conscious state or an unconscious state. And therefore, you could make the case there, okay, they're not going to eat anymore because they're unconscious. They're going to be dying.
Right, and
soon.
Even if they're not unconscious, it's part of the natural process. Your body doesn't want food or water anymore. There's nothing to do with that nourishment.
What really happens in the case of Terry Schiavo, who is not unconscious, who has been kept alive only by the feeding tube for this last decade? What happens when such a person is deprived of hydration?
Well, I've done quite a bit of research on this for my books, Forced Exit and Culture of Death, because I think it's an important point. And a lot of people have been, I believe, sold a bill of goods by people who want access to dehydrate people based on a quality of life judgment. And realizing that it's pretty intuitive that that would cause suffering, they try to pretend it doesn't. But I asked a neurologist what would happen, and here's what he told me, and this is a quote. A conscious, cognitively disabled person would feel it just as you or I would. They will go into seizures. Their skin cracks, their tongue cracks, their lips crack. They may have nosebleeds because of the drying of the mucous membranes, and heaving and vomiting might ensue because of the dying out of the stomach lining. They feel the pangs of hunger and thirst. Remember, we're not talking about the cancer patient, and we have to emphasize that. They feel the pangs of hunger and thirst. Imagine going one day without a glass of water. Death by dehydration takes 10 to 14 days. It is an extremely agonizing death. Now, when somebody doesn't want to eat anymore as they're dying of cancer, they don't die of dehydration. They die of cancer. In this situation, we're talking about somebody who is not terminally ill, who is not dying, except if you take away food and water, every one of us is dying. So Dr. Burke, a neurologist, says that's horrible, and this is what can occur. And he opposes dehydration. That's one of the reasons he does. He happens to be a right-to-life person. But let's say if you think that's biased because he opposes dehydration, Minnesota neurologist Ronald Cranford, who is a pro-dehydration activist, who has testified in all of the major cases since Nancy Cruz Ann, that this cognitively disabled people should die by dehydration, including Terry Schiavo, said this in the Robert Wendland case on the witness stand, and I saw him do it, and it cast quite a pall over the courtroom, I must say. Quote, after 7 to 9 days from commencing dehydration, the patient begins to lose all fluids in the body, a lot of fluids in the body, and their blood pressure starts to go down, and when their blood pressure goes down, their heart rate goes up. The respiration may increase, and then the blood is shunted to the central part of the body from the periphery of the body. so that usually 2 to 3 days prior to death, sometimes 4 days, the hands and the feet become extremely cold. They become mottled. That is, you look at the hands and they have a bluish appearance, and the mouth dries a great deal, and the eyes dry a great deal, and other parts of the body become mottled, and that is because the blood is now so low in the system, it is shunted to the heart and other visceral organs and away from the periphery of the body. So whether you're an anti-dehydration person like Dr. Burke or a pro-dehydration person like Ronald Cranford, you can see it's not a pleasant death.
Tell us about Kate Adamson.
Kate Adamson is a woman who at age 33 collapsed from a devastating and a terribly incapacitating stroke. Doctors thought she was going to become PVS from this, but actually what she was in was a locked-in state. That is, she was conscious but unable to communicate. So the doctors are saying to her husband, you have to let her go, which would have meant, by the way, dying by dehydration. She ended up with the husband was refusing that, and she ended up with a blockage in her intestine. And there was surgery done to cure that blockage, which meant that she had to go without tube feeding for 8 days. And then she came back, and she regained her ability to communicate. So she's able to tell us what she, as a conscious patient, experienced being without tube feeding. And she went on the Bill O'Reilly Show, and here's what she said. When the feeding tube was turned off for 8 days, I thought I was going insane. I was screaming out in my mind, don't you know I need to eat? And even up until that point, I had been having a bag full of Ensure, that's the formula, as my nourishment that was going through the feeding tube. At that point, it sounded pretty good. I just wanted something. The fact that I had nothing, the hunger pains, overrode every thought I had. And O'Reilly says, so you were feeling pain when they removed your tube. They didn't actually remove her tube, they clamped it. She said, yes, oh, absolutely, absolutely. To say that, especially when Michael Schiavo on national TV mentioned last week that it's a pretty painless thing to have the feeding tube removed, it is the exact opposite. It was sheer torture, Bill. O'Reilly, just amazing. Adamson, sheer torture. So I called. I wrote this article for the Weekly Standard Online, the Daily Standard, and I talked to Kate, and I asked her to describe this even further. She said, believe it or not, Todd, that the pain of going without food for 8 days was worse than the pain she experienced from the blockage surgery in her abdomen. You see, because the doctors had what she was going on with her wrong, they didn't give her enough anesthesia. And so she felt the surgery. Can you imagine? Mm. She felt the abdominal surgery. And here's what she told me. The agony of going without food was a constant pain that lasted not several hours like my operation did, but several days. You have to endure the physical pain, and on top of that, you have to endure the emotional pain. Your whole body cries out, feed me, I am alive and a person, don't let me die for God's sake, somebody feed me. So then I asked her about her thirst. She was not being dehydrated to death, and so they put an IV in her, a saline IV. That didn't do anything in terms of her thirst. Here's what she said. I craved anything to drink, anything. I obsessively visualized drinking from a huge bottle of orange Gatorade, and I hate orange Gatorade. I did receive lemon-flavored mouth swabs to alleviate dryness, but they did nothing to slack my desperate thirst. So here you have it, a woman who was receiving some liquid through the saline solution, and was only without food and most water for 8 days instead of the 10 to 14 it takes to die by dehydration. And she called it torture and agony. And she came back to tell us what she experienced. So if Terry is conscious, which she certainly seems to me, and there's no question that she experiences, she reacts to pain stimuli, and realizing beyond Terry Schiavo that conscious, cognitively disabled patients are routinely dehydrated in this country in all 50 states, we may be consigning a lot of people to death in a way because they can't communicate, they can't tell us what they're experiencing. That is agonizing.
I want to come back to this intentional confusion that Michael Schiavo and his lawyer are now in the habit of engaging in between the terminally ill and Terry Schiavo's case of being cognitively disabled. Is this unique to Michael and his lawyer?
No, it's done all the time. And the media, the we've talked about what I call the establishment media versus dissident media. Dissident media being like Issues, etc. Talk show hosts who are able to move beyond the paradigm of spin and the elite attitudes about these things. You will see bioethicists going on television all the time and saying, well, you know, when a cancer patient is dying, it has a sedative effect. And or they'll even say, well, because you're eating, you're not eating and chewing and swallowing, but you're having a feeding tube, that makes a difference. That makes no difference. The only they call it artificial nutrition also to try to make it seem like it's not a natural process. The only thing artificial is that the food is being delivered directly into the intestine, small intestine, instead of going through the mouth, through chewing, and then the initial digestion in the stomach. But the digestion itself is not artificial at all. They don't call insulin artificial insulin when they give somebody insulin, which is a life-sustaining medical treatment. I mean, it's the idea of the artificial nutrition being withheld, having a different experience for the patient dehydrating to death than would be experienced by withholding food and water through the mouth is nonsense.
We're talking with Wesley Smith, an update on the euthanasia case of Terry Schiavo. He's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia-Assisted Suicide. He's authored this book titled Forced Exit, among others, The Slippery Slope, From Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. Wesley, what's Terry's situation at present?
Well, you know, it shifts every single day. Terry is back on her tube feeding. Her parents say that she seems to have regained her strength. You know, she was dehydrated for 6 days. And who knows what she experienced during that 6 days. Hopefully someday she'll be able to be rehabilitated to the point where she can be able to let us know. There is a medical difference over this, but many doctors and medical experts that the Schiavos have, I'm sorry, the Schindlers, her parents, have shown the videos to and a few that have examined her, say that she is capable of rehab, at least off the feeding tube perhaps, and perhaps even an improvement in her cognitive situation. If she is ever able to be rehabilitated to the point where she can communicate, it would be very interesting to learn what she experienced during those 6 days, which, by the way, is the second time she's been cut off from her feeding tube. The first time was for 2 days. In any event, she seems to be none the worse for wear in that situation. Terry's law, which permitted Jeb Bush to step in and put a moratorium on her dehydration, is being attacked in the courts by Michael Schiavo. The ACLU, which would sue if you did this to a condemned prisoner, if you dehydrated a condemned prisoner, the ACLU would never stop suing, and properly so, because that would be cruel and unusual punishment, has jumped to the defense of Michael and is working very hard to make Terry dead by dehydration, believing that Terry's law is unconstitutional and an attack on her right to privacy. A judge, apparently the Michael Schiavo sued the governor in the wrong court. He's supposed to be sued in Tallahassee, state capital, so that the governor doesn't have to, you know, fly all over the state defending these cases. Instead, the suit was brought in Clearwater in that area, and so there's a motion to dismiss by Governor Bush on the basis that there was improper service. That was denied by the trial judge in this case, who, by the way, has his chambers right next to Judge Greer's chambers, who ordered the dehydration. That was then appealed, which put in an automatic stay. The trial judge then took away the automatic stay, but then a court of appeals put the stay back in place. So tomorrow, I hope I haven't been too complicated here. Tomorrow, Michael has to defend why there should not continue to be a stay pending an appeal on the issue of whether the governor was served in the proper place. This is a case that it gets convoluted and is a different twist and turn every day. So at the moment, Terry's law remains in effect, and there is a guardian ad litem looking into the situation to see whether she should get extra therapy.
On the subject of the guardian ad litem, you wrote recently about Terry's first guardian ad litem and a report that was filed there. What did it say?
The first guardian ad litem, Terry should have had a guardian ad litem through this whole process. She's an incapacitated person, and therefore she should have had somebody who was solely there to look out after her interests. Accordingly, when the case was first filed in 1998, she had a guardian ad litem. He filed a report to the court, was asked to issue a recommendation. He recommended against the dehydration. At that time, there was more than $700,000 in Terry's trust fund that was there because of a medical malpractice case. Also, Michael was moving on with his life, and so the guardian said that, well, he didn't think that this was appropriate given the conflicts of interest that Michael had. The judges in the Schiavo case said, well, thank you very much. We appreciate your report. Thank you for sharing. And went on to completely disregard the report and never appointed a second guardian ad litem, which should have occurred in this case.
What's to keep Michael Schiavo from divorcing Terry and going on with his life?
Well, nothing, but he doesn't want to do that. He says that he is going to defend her right not to have treatment, that he still loves her, yet he's estranged himself from the marriage. In my view, he has been living with another woman since 1996. They've got two children, one that has been born for sure, and one that I believe may have just been born or is about to be born. He's in a whole new life. He has a new family. In that situation, I would say he's estranged from his marriage, but he is insisting that he gets to have the benefits of his marriage, meaning whatever's left in that trust fund he gets to inherit, and he doesn't have to divide marital property. Florida's a community property state. 50-50 division would occur. And he gets to have connubial bliss with his the woman he calls his fiancée. He could divorce her, but he won't. The courts could say, well, Michael, you've moved on with your life. Fine, we're going to have, as it seemed to me to be common sense, have her parents and her siblings care for her since you now have a different life, you have different priorities, let her parents care for her. But the courts have so far refused to do that. So we're kind of stuck in the situation where Michael won't divorce his wife, he wants to end her life through dehydration. He has another family. He has moved on with his life. He specifically said recently in the media, I've moved on with my life. It's too bad Mr. Schindler can't move on with his. Well, the way he's moving on with his life is to end Terry's life.
Wesley Smith, thank you again for joining us and being our guest on Issues Etc. We'll have you back soon for another update.
Thanks, Todd.
Wesley Smith, he's an attorney for the International Task Force on Euthanasia and Assisted Suicide, a senior fellow for the Discovery Institute, and author of several books, including Forced Exit, The Slippery Slope from Assisted Suicide to Legalized Murder. You can read all of Wesley's insights on this case and on other subjects, on the Terry Schiavo case and on all other subjects, at his website, WesleyJSmith.com. It's WesleyJSmith, all one word, .com. Or you can purchase his book, Forced Exit, by calling Spence Publishing at 1-888-SPENPUB. That's 1-888-SPENPUB, or online at www.spencepublishing.com, www.spencepublishing.com. When we come back from this break, we're going to be talking with Peter Sprague, senior marriage analyst for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. The Massachusetts Supreme Court today ruled that a ban against gay marriage is unconstitutional in that state. We'll sort out exactly what this decision means and will mean when we come back.
Defending life from beginning to end. You're listening to Issues Etc.
If you're a talk radio junkie like me, you might assume that the programming is free. Commercial advertisers pay for the production costs and staff salaries. Well, that's true for most talk radio shows, but not for Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is listener-supported. That means we rely on you to pay the production salaries and airtime costs for this worldwide outreach. Hi, this is Todd Wilkin asking you to prayerfully consider making a financial gift to Issues Etc. today. You can donate online, issuesetc.org. Click on the What's New section. You can donate by credit card, 1-800-737-0172, or you can donate by check, Issues Etc., Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. Remember, unlike other talk radio shows, Issues Etc. needs your financial support. We depend upon you for the continuation and expansion of Issues Etc.
Now, this Global Minute focuses prayer on your children or other kids you know. The prayer is that they'll develop a passion for sharing Christ around the world. Some easy ways to get your children interested in missions includes helping them make connections with service projects in your church. Stay updated on one or two international news events and pray with your family for the people who are impacted. Another resource is the Worldwide Kids Club, a group of children and young people who are dedicated to going into all the world and preaching the gospel. Log on to www.worldwidekidsclub.com for mission tips and mission-oriented songs. And continue to pray that no matter what career your child chooses, that they'll use their talents in Christ's global service. Get more information at worldwidekidsclub.com or call 1-800-804-9524. That's 1-800-804-9524.
Welcome to the Meyer Minute. Last Saturday, 23 people were killed when suicide car bombers attacked two synagogues in Istanbul. For thousands of years of civilized history, holy places were considered safe places, sanctuaries where people could flee to save their lives. For example, a man named Adonijah, afraid for his life, took refuge at an altar, 1 Kings chapter 1. Joshua 20 describes safe towns, where an accused person could take refuge and be protected from mob violence. This isn't just Jewish history. The Roman historian Tacitus lists holy sites in the Greco-Roman world to which people could flee for safety. The custom was an outgrowth of an instinct God put in the heart of man, an instinct to seek refuge, and ideally that should be in him as he has revealed himself to us. Saturday's attack shows the innocent are not safe in holy places, and evil people use religious zeal as a cover for murder. The analysis of Tacitus. No authority was strong enough, he says, to check the turbulence of a people which protected the crimes of men as much as the worship of God. This isn't just a war against terror. It's a war for civilization. I'm Dale Meyer.
Here's a very special AM 850K, if you will, salute to our day sponsor on this Tuesday, November 18th, 2003, Diana Brown. Today's day sponsor has made a contribution to AM 850K, if you will, in celebration of Diana's birthday. Once again, a very special thank you to Diana Brown of St. Louis, today's AM 850K, if you will, day sponsor. And best wishes from all of us here at AM 850K, if you will, for a very happy birthday.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're finishing that conversation with Wesley Smith on the other side of the break, and I was thinking about very recently, I was here in St. Louis, out in Clayton, emceeing the latest Vitae Caring Foundation dinner that Lutherans for Life of Greater St. Louis puts on. It's almost an annual thing, and it's very encouraging to meet Issues Etc. listeners there at an event like that. I said to several people when I was there, it's one of the favorite things I do. I do a lot of speaking by invitation throughout the course of the year here in the St. Louis area and across the nation. And doing the pro-life dinners is one of the favorite things I do. This is something I have observed. I have observed that Issues Etc. listeners are very well informed on the pro-life issue, perhaps better informed than fans of other radio programs that deal with the pro-life issue. And we are proud to defend life from beginning to end. If you enjoy the not only the lively conversation, but also the solid defense of life from beginning to end that we offer you here at Issues Etc., I'd like to encourage you to become a monthly contributor. We're excited about this because this is the first time we've had level giving. I started doing this job 5 years ago, thereabouts. We were talking about it. By that time, it was already an old idea in the mind of my producer, and it's actually become a reality. Monthly giving at one of three levels, either the confessor, the apologist, or the reformer. Now, the confessor, for $25 a month or for an annual gift of $250, you get, as our thanks to you for your help to support Issues Etc., a subscription to the Issues Etc. journal, an Issues Etc. tape of the month, and the book by Craig Parton, The Defense Never Rests. At the level of the apologist, that's $50 per month or an annual gift of $500. You get all the benefits of being a confessor, plus a quarterly Issues Etc. book of the month. That's four books total for the year. At the level of the reformer, which is $100 a month or an annual gift of $1,000, you get all of the benefits of the confessor and the apologist's level, plus you get three Issues Etc. journal subscriptions, two Issues Etc. tapes of the month, a written transcript. This is the first time that we've ever delved into written transcripts, too. A written transcript of each of the Issues Etc. tapes of the month and the Issues Etc. book of the month every month. That's 12 books total at the level of the reformer, $100 per month or $1,000 per year. Now, to become a confessor, an apologist, or a reformer, call our 24-hour automated resource line at 1-800-737-0172. 1-800-737-0172. You can also send your first gift to Issues Etc. via regular mail, P.O. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. P.O. Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri, 63117. When you call, when you write, make sure you indicate what level of support and whether you'd like to become a monthly or an annual contributor to Issues Etc. The remainder of this hour, we're going to spend talking with Peter Sprague. He is Senior Marriage Analyst for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. We're going to talk about the Massachusetts Supreme Court decision today that declared a ban on gay marriage unconstitutional. Peter, welcome to Issues Etc.
Thank you very much for having me.
What did the Massachusetts Supreme Court decide today?
They decided that limitation of marriage to unions of one man and one woman under state law violated the Massachusetts state constitution. They ruled that it violated a fundamental right to marry that belongs to every citizen of the Commonwealth.
What is the history of this particular issue in the state of Massachusetts? Has it been working its way through the judicial system, I assume, since it's made its way to the Supreme Court?
Yes. This case began in April of 2001. It's probably fair to say it was carefully plotted out and planned. The plaintiffs were seven same-sex couples. I believe it was four lesbian couples and three homosexual male couples went to their local town clerk in Massachusetts and requested marriage licenses, said they wanted to get married. They were denied marriage licenses, and they filed this lawsuit as a result. Now, the trial court, turned down their request, said, you don't need to be talking to the courts, you need to be talking to the legislature. They appealed that decision, and both the state and the plaintiffs agreed to take the appeal directly to the Supreme Judicial Court of Massachusetts, which is the highest court in the state. And there is a seven-member court, and today they voted 4-3 same-sex couples should be issued marriage licenses. However, they stayed the decision for 180 days to give the legislature a chance to respond.
So let me see if I have this straight. The Supreme Court basically said that to bar people legally in the state of Massachusetts of the same sex from marrying is unconstitutional.
Right.
And that the legislature has 6 months to devise laws that would recognize same-sex marriage.
Well, yeah, it's interesting that on the stay, they gave the legislature 6 months to respond, and it was not made clear whether they were inviting the legislature to pass a same-sex marriage statute or whether they are inviting the legislature to amend the Constitution to prohibit same-sex marriage. And we certainly are hoping that the legislature will do the latter. In fact, there is an amendment to the state constitution that is already pending in the legislature. It's called the Marriage Affirmation and Protection Amendment, or Ma and Pa for short. And the legislature actually met last week in constitutional convention to consider this amendment and voted to postpone action on it until next February. There's been a little cat and mouse game going on in Massachusetts with the court seemingly waiting for the legislature to act and the legislature waiting for the court, but now the court has acted and we hope the legislature will respond by passing this amendment. However, it would have to be adopted in two consecutive sessions of the legislature and then go on the ballot and be approved by the voters in order to become part of the Constitution. So that would take at least until November of 2006. And it's not clear whether the court would be willing to extend their stay in order to allow the voters to actually have their say on this issue.
See, I guess at that point you would discover whether or not the Supreme Court is trying to give the legislature the opportunity to amend the Constitution or telling the legislature it's time to pass a legal recognition of same-sex marriage. I mean, if they're willing to extend their stay, at least you've got some indication there.
Right. Well, we would hope that they would, if the legislature passes this amendment, that the court would extend its stay on the reasoning that if the amendment process were to be completed and same-sex marriages were to be banned again, then you would have this narrow window of 2 years in which certain, people would have, same-sex couples would have married, but then after that they would no longer be able to do so, and, their legal marriages for a brief period of time would then become illegal, or, it would be a very messy situation legally, so we would hope they would extend that stay.
Now, apart from the actions of the legislature that you just described for us, is there any way of determining what the mind of the Massachusetts legislature is on this particular issue of same-sex marriage?
Well, we believe that there is not a majority in favor of same-sex marriage by any means. But on the other hand, I'm not certain there is yet a sufficient majority to pass a constitutional amendment. We are supporting the efforts of a Family Policy Council in Massachusetts to continue lobbying on this issue. The interesting thing, though, is that unlike what the Vermont court did a few years ago, the Massachusetts court has not given the legislature the out or the option of adopting an institution parallel to marriage with the same rights and benefits but a different name, which Vermont did when they adopted civil unions. So the legislators will face a stark choice. They will have to go on record. Either they support the traditional definition of marriage or they support the full rights of civil marriage for homosexual couples. The court has not allowed a middle ground.
Do we know what the thought of the governor of Massachusetts, Mitt Romney, is?
Well, I'm not sure exactly. There's been some discussion in the media up there that both with the legislature and with respect to the governor that there might be the makings of a political compromise in terms of adopting some sort of domestic partner scheme or civil unions program that would give the material and legal and financial benefits of marriage to same-sex couples without actually putting it on the same, giving it the exact same status, the exact same status as marriage. But as I said, this decision by the Supreme Court of Massachusetts seems to foreclose that as an option. They feel that it's the marriage laws that apply. It's the institution of marriage that these couples are entitled to participate in.
So, if let's say just for the sake of argument that some compromise is struck, that Romney, who is on the record, is saying, "Look, I want marriage to be between a man and a woman, but I also want to have some kind of protections for civil rights and appropriate benefits for non-traditional couples," and they end up with something alike unto what Vermont has, have they basically arrived at same-sex marriage just by a different route?
Well, that's our position at the Family Research Council. We are adamantly opposed to the adoption of domestic partner benefits or civil unions to recognize same-sex couples. we want to protect the institution of marriage, not just protect the word marriage. And we feel that just slapping a different label on it really doesn't matter, that it's if it's marriage in all but name, it's the same as marriage. The problem is homosexual relationships are not the same as marriage. They are more unstable. They are more short-lived. They are less, far less likely to be characterized by sexual fidelity. And so if the label of marriage is placed on same-sex relationships, then society's concept of marriage will be diluted and devalued, and that's where the real harm comes from, we think.
One of the questions that always comes up, in fact, I was talking yesterday with an author of an article in Touchstone magazine about this very issue, and he brought it up again, and that is the full faith and credit clause of the U.S. Constitution. We're already kind of faced with a bit of a crisis, aren't we? Vermont says yes to same-sex unions. Massachusetts may say yes. Others have tried to say yes. But the rest of the states say, what are we to do with these things when people cross state lines and take up residence where we don't recognize them?
Exactly. And that's where this, you know, the battle is going to inevitably come to the federal courts because of those interstate issues. Now, I do want to emphasize that the Massachusetts court made its decision based only on provisions of the Massachusetts state constitution. So this decision cannot be appealed to the federal courts, cannot be overruled by the federal courts because it's not a federal issue. However, if couples, if same-sex couples go to Massachusetts and get married and then come back to another state and seek legal recognition of that marriage in their home states, or if they move to another state and seek recognition, then that will set up legal challenges. In states with a Defense of Marriage Act already on the books, they may challenge the state Defense of Marriage Act, and they may challenge the federal Defense of Marriage Act, which put Congress on record saying that any given state does not have to recognize same-sex marriages entered into in another state. But some people argue that that's unconstitutional because of the full faith and credit clause that you mentioned. So this is inevitably, I mean, unless Massachusetts forestalls the impact of this decision through a constitutional amendment, if same-sex couples actually begin to marry in Massachusetts, it will inevitably set up, it will open the floodgates to federal litigation challenging both state and federal Defense of Marriage Acts and seeking, in effect, to win recognition for these marriages in all 50 states.
Well, now, what in fact did happen in the Vermont case, I think I'm correct in remembering that a significant number of the same-sex union ceremonies performed in Vermont were performed for people who crossed state lines simply to have a same-sex union.
Exactly. That's true. And so, you know, it has been, Vermont has become a magnet for homosexual couples who want to enter into, you know, a union that is legally recognized somewhere. Now, efforts to win legal recognition in other states for Vermont civil unions have been unsuccessful thus far because no other state has civil unions. The courts have generally just ruled that, well, we don't have anything comparable to this. And so, but if they are granted marriage in Massachusetts, then that argument will not hold, and the states and the federal courts will be forced to address the issue.
We're talking with Peter Sprague. He is senior marriage analyst for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. The Massachusetts Supreme Court today ruled that a ban on gay marriage in that state is unconstitutional according to the Massachusetts Constitution. Let's talk about the amendment that is being talked about to the U.S. Constitution, a federal marriage amendment that would define marriage as being between a man and a woman. How much traction do you think that has?
Well, I think it's going to gain a lot more traction as a result of today's decision. Some people who have wanted to sort of avoid dealing with this issue have said, look, we don't have same-sex marriage in any state in the union. This is a solution in search of a problem. It's premature, et cetera, et cetera. Well, they really can't say that anymore. You know, barring a constitutional amendment in Massachusetts, we will have same-sex marriage in a U.S. state. 6 months from now. So anybody who believes that marriage should be limited to the union of a man and a woman has got to recognize that this is a very imminent threat. And we believe that a federal marriage amendment is the most effective way to address it.
What has to happen for that to become a reality? Walk us through the process.
An amendment to the Constitution has to be approved by a two-thirds vote of both houses of Congress, and then by three-quarters of the states. Generally speaking, it's the state legislatures which vote on the ratification of constitutional amendments.
So it wouldn't be a public referendum state to state?
It would not be a public referendum. Now, the Constitution does allow for a constitutional conventions in the states as an alternative to having the already elected legislature make these decisions. And some people have suggested using that as an alternative so that people could run for election as a delegate to the Constitutional Convention based explicitly on their position on this issue. I don't believe that route has been used for a long, long time. So generally it would go to the state legislatures. Now, what's significant is three-quarters of the state legislatures is 38 states, and I believe that's exactly the number of states that have already defined marriage as the union of one man and one woman in their own state law or state constitutions. So I think it's not at all unrealistic to think that a federal marriage amendment could win ratification from the states if we can get it through Congress.
So we're talking Vermont, Massachusetts. What state is the next for us to watch on this particular issue?
Well, actually, Massachusetts was the last state with a sort of currently pending same-sex marriage case that I was aware of, because the other states which had these cases pending have all decided them recently the other way. Just this year, Indiana, Arizona, and New Jersey courts have all rejected a claim to a right for same-sex marriage. Now, I don't have all of them right fresh in my mind. It's possible that one or more of those may have been just a lower court decision, and so it may still be on appeal to the Supreme Court of those states. But thus far, the three states that have ruled on this issue this year have all ruled the other way. Massachusetts is the first that has gone in the direction of a right to same-sex marriage.
Picking up on that, what do surveys say beyond the fact that we have 38 states that have already defined marriage as a man and a woman? What do surveys seem to indicate about the public mind regarding same-sex unions, and do those numbers change when you talk about same-sex marriage?
Well, yes, and in fact, one of my colleagues just brought in a new poll that was just published today. There is an article about it on the MSNBC website, and I think the poll was actually conducted for the Pew Forum on Religion and Public Life, and this poll conducted October 15th through 19th of this year found that 59% of the American public is opposed to gay marriage, with only 32% in support of it. That's a 27-point margin. So that's pretty overwhelming, and reinforces findings of some other polls earlier this summer that in the wake of the Supreme Court decision striking down the Texas sodomy law, the case of Lawrence v. Texas in late June, sympathy for the homosexual movement in general and for homosexual marriage in particular has actually dropped rather than increased. So I think that as these issues are in the news and people focus on it more, they become more alarmed. And we see a clear majority opposed to homosexual marriage.
With only a minute and a half before we have to wrap up our conversation, Peter, someone's going to say, look, live and let live. In terms of society, in terms of our culture and our society, how is it going to hurt us to have same-sex unions or same-sex marriages? answer that question?
Well, there are two things. First of all, people presume that that homosexuals are you know, always homosexual for their entire life and can never change, and therefore utterly uninterested in relationships with the opposite sex. The fact is, many people who now identify as homosexual have previously been in heterosexual marriages and have divorced. So I do think that it gives an option that will increase the divorce rate. And also, there are many former homosexuals who have now married people of the opposite sex and are happily married, and they weren't prevented from doing that. Secondly, though, is that because homosexual relationships are unstable and characterized by promiscuity and infidelity, this will change the image that we have of what marriage is. And even heterosexual people will go, this is a generational change, I think, in future generations, will enter marriage without the expectation that marriage is a lifelong commitment, without the expectation that it's a sexually exclusive relationship. And this will just continue the harm to marriage that's already been done by the divorce, expansion of no-fault divorce and the sexual revolution and so forth.
Peter Sprague, thank you very much for being our guest on Issues Etc.
You're very welcome. Thank you.
Peter Sprague is Senior Marriage Analyst for the Family Research Council based in Washington, D.C. If you'd like to visit the Family Research Council on the web, very simple website, frc.org, frc.org, or you can call them at area code 202-393-2100, area code 202-393-2100. When we come back from this break, second hour of Issues Etc. makes me a little sad. We're going to have to conclude our five-part series with Pastor Will Wheaton on the Liturgy of Holy Baptism. We'll have Pastor Wheaton back for another series. I think we're brewing something up with him, but as of today, the last part, we're going to talk about why when someone is baptized, they are often given a white robe. Why are they given a candle? And how does the whole historic liturgy surrounding holy baptism, highlighting holy baptism, how does it end? Really, does it end? That's a good question. Does it ever end? Pastor Will Wheaton will answer those questions when we come back after this break. He's pastor of St. Paul Lutheran Church in Hamel, Illinois. Something to watch, folks. When we've got, Vermont, Massachusetts, and the possibility of a federal marriage amendment, definitely subjects that bear watching. We'll keep on bringing you more information on Issues Etc. We'll be right back.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for Issues Etc. to continue. Our address is Post Office Box 9360, St. Louis, Missouri 63117. Or you can contact us via our website at www.issuesetc.org. That's www.issuesetc.org. For a cassette copy of the program, call 1-800-737-0172. That's 1-800-737-0172. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of this station or the Jubilee Network. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.